Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
This assistance will be calculated using a flat payment rate for the eligible commodity multiplied by the eligible reported acres. For acres reported as prevented plants for 2024, ECAP assistance will be calculated at 50%.
Deputy Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation, Brooke Appleton.
We developed an online calculator for producers to estimate their ECAP payment. This is on our FSA website, along with a list of eligible commodities and per acre rates. Sign up runs through August 15th, but producers do not have to wait for their pre-filled application to apply. They can visit their local office or go on the FSA website to start applying. If a producer does not receive a pre-filled ECAP application and they planted or were prevented from planting ECAP eligible commodities in 2024, their best bet is just to go into the local FSA office. They'll have all their information on hand.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Here's the MedPAC report.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert is chairman of the Joint Economic Committee.
Well, it turns out around here, actually reading the actual math and the concepts. So if I came to you right now and said, like in here, there's a whole paragraph that's saying there's something wrong in Medicare Advantage data. Now, MedPAC report says Medicare Advantage, really important program. We need to keep it. But we're going to have to dive in on how to modernize how it works. Because here, coding intensity, they made the adjustments for coding intensity, but it basically says, translates into a projected $84 billion, or 17% of total payments, meaning Medicare Advantage, coming at $84 billion this year, more than fee-for-service. And that's with the adjustments for renal failure and other things. So what would happen if I came to you right now and said, we can do things to fix these outliers and costs and never cut a service by changing the incentives? Instead of the incentives that the MedPAC report talks about of scoring people as sicker and sicker and taking that additional spiff spending, how about a system that says, why don't we incentivize the providers in this program to help our brothers and sisters who are seniors be healthier, and that making your population, helping them be healthier, is actually your profit? Is that heresy? I would argue that's just good design, and we don't have a choice. Because last week, the Joint Economic Committee, we published a report. I chair the Joint Economic Committee, and I appreciate we have remarkably hardworking economists, and we're trying very hard, but we're willing to go to places that are politically dangerous but mathematically honest, which is something that rarely happens around here. But we tried to touch on things like how fragile is U.S. debt to higher interest rates. Fact of the matter is, I did a chart a couple weeks ago that showed if the United States went back to a 6% handle on U.S. sovereign debt. Now, you go, well, that's a lot higher than we're at today. Yeah, but go back to the early 2000s, we were right up against 6%. You do realize in 9 budget years, if you are at 6%, it would mean 45% of all U.S. tax collections go just to interest. We do a chapter here on the effects of obesity to our society, to spending, to longevity, to family formation. Last year's report came in over $9 trillion. This year, we even define it more to understand what happens when the single biggest spend in our society could actually be mitigated by helping our brothers and sisters in the country be healthier. Are we allowed to talk about that, or is that just heresy? Because once again, got to tell the truth, over the next 30 years, Social Security and Medicare represent all the borrowing. And it's like $116 trillion of borrowing. Discretionary, which we talk about a lot because that's where you find some of the really stupid spending, the shiny objects, is projected to grow slower than tax receipts. My point is, for everyone out there who wants to be enraged by the White House, enraged by those of us who are trying to find solutions, bring us ideas. Bring us actual math. Stop making crap up. But if you're going to give us ideas, actually maybe read your subject area first. You'd be amazed how many things we get, where if we just didn't have foreign aid and we show the chart that it's a week of borrowing. Understand, you have a country that our baseline is going to be borrowing about $6 billion a day. How long do you think we can do that?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Wildlife management aims to maintain the long-term viability and sustainability of wildlife populations and seeks to enhance the positive contributions of these species while also reducing their negative impacts on people and ecosystems.
Dr. Nathan Roberts is a professor of conservation and wildlife management at the College of the Ozarks.
Managing carnivores is complex and challenging due to the various factors, including their intricate ecological impacts, both positive and negative, the potential for conflicts, differing public interest, and a complex legal and regulatory framework. Wildlife managers successfully address these challenges using a wide range of well-established tools and strategies. Regulations and policies are carefully designed to meet specific conservation goals. In some cases, this means temporarily prohibiting the take of a species, while in other takes, regulated take may be allowed. In some cases, conflicts may be addressed through non-lethal methods, but in other cases, lethal methods may be necessary. Similarly, in some situations, the best approach may be reactive and to respond to conflicts after they've occurred, while in other cases, it's the most efficient to be proactive and reduce the probability of conflicts by managing population size and habitat. There's a time and a place for each of these approaches, but there's not a single approach that is appropriate for all cases. State wildlife agencies are best equipped to make these decisions as they have the local knowledge and experience needed. It is critical for wildlife managers to have a diverse toolbox equipped with a variety of approaches and techniques to employ to achieve conservation objectives. The management of wildlife is a primary responsibility of state fish and wildlife agencies. When a species is listed under the Endangered Species Act, the federal government temporarily assumes management authority while the species recovers and is no longer at immediate risk of extinction. During this temporary period, certain conservation tools that are typically used to achieve management goals may be restricted while the species is at the greatest risk of extinction. The problem comes when the ESA is abused, the intent of the act is distorted, and the species remains listed for decades after recovery goals are met, denying professional state wildlife managers the use of all the conservation tools in their toolbox. The gray wolf is a prime example of these problems. The gray wolf in the United States is clearly recovered and stable, yet it remains listed as an endangered species. The recovery plan established in the Great Lakes region sets specific numeric goals as criteria for determining successful recovery that have been surpassed every year since at least 1994, with an estimated 4,000 to 5,000 wolves in this region alone. The Department of Interior has issued numerous rules to delist wolves, only to have these rules vacated through litigation. Despite exceeding the population criteria for restoration by more than tenfold, wolves remain listed, and state agencies still do not have management authority or their toolbox restored. While wolves may not occupy their entire historic range, the overall population in the United States remains secure and in no danger of extinction. State wildlife management agencies have demonstrated their ability to effectively manage wolves as well as other wildlife. In the Rocky Mountains, wolves have been delisted for many years. There may be debate about management strategies, but there is no question that wolves continue to inhabit and thrive in this region. Keeping wolves listed is inappropriate and harmful to overall conservation efforts, weakens the integrity of ESA, and misallocates limited conservation resources. The ongoing cycle of litigation, ignoring established scientific recovery benchmarks, creates disincentive for landowners and jurisdictions to engage in species recovery, and states are needlessly restricted from effectively managing wolf populations and implementing proactive strategies, such as maintaining populations within a desired range to achieve wildlife management goals that maximize positive benefits, minimize negative impacts, while also ensuring the species' long-term viability.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
U.S. meat trade, small adjustments this month.
Chairman of USDA's World Ag Outlook Board is Dr. Mark Jackanowski.
Beef exports raised, reflecting higher supplies, especially in the second half. In the U.S. Pork exports lowered 75 million pounds this month. Seeing that we're relatively less competitive in several markets, including China recently. Broiler export forecast also lowered 75 million pounds. Seeing a lot of competition out of Brazil. So, and our price is relatively high relative to Brazil. And turkey export forecast lowered 25 million pounds just based on lower production here in the U.S. Beef imports, very strong, raised our import forecast 105 million pounds this month. We saw record imports in January and continued strong demand, high beef prices in the U.S., strong need for that for those beef imports, and mostly coming from Oceania.
Randy Sainer is an extension program leader with the University of Nebraska at Lincoln on increasing number of cows.
If you go from 24 cows to 48 cows per bull, you could about cut that cost per cow in half. Now, if you put one bull without any cows, you better hope he's a good breeder and those kind of things. And that's the challenges you take. But that's one way. Or another option would be to, you know, if you have a spring calving and a fall calving herd, you divide that bull in half. So, I mean, he gets way more cows that way. And that's another way you can reduce the cost is if you have two herds, you're using twice a year. And so you're putting him on more cows. But some people will go with a larger number of cows. The big thing you got to watch is make sure that if he's by himself, you check him out. Because if he gets hurt, you're not going to get those cows bred. And it may stretch the time of calving out a little bit if the bull gets overworked. So those are things to think about.
The topic was how much to pay for a bull. He says there's a bull calculator on the UNL website.
So you can put in what it takes to take care of a bull. You can put in what your bull value is when you call it, and then what your price is. And you can try different prices and see how that affects your cost per bull, or your cost per cow, I'm sorry. And so what you do is, you can estimate the weaning cost per weaned calf. And then if there's an added value, so let's say that, you know, you get a higher weaning weight, then you can put that in there. And then that'll tell you if paying that extra money for that bull is really worth it or not. Because you're going to have to get so much more, right, to really pay for that extra value and that the cost in that bull. And when I did that, like I said, that 350 cow herd, which was or 300 cow herd, which was one that we have on the website there for Southwest. I use Southwest Nebraska because that's where I'm at, and that's where I figured those figures from. But you can put all that in this calculator, and it'll come out. And the nice thing is, if you want to just keep everything the same and see how price affects your cost per cow, you can do that also. And I did that, and I've got a couple tables on that. But price per bull, you know, as you get from 7,000, which was about $85.23 per weaned calf, up to $16,000 bulls, and I've seen several of those sell, you're talking $214. So almost double what it costs for the 7,000. So either that bull's got to get you more, do better for you or something. So you want to think about that when you're buying it. And that the calculator will do that for you.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It is deeply disingenuous to the point of gaslighting to suggest that anything about this legislation before us, which absolutely weakens the Endangered Species Act, that anything about this is about making the law work better or bringing it back to its original intent. The original intent was to save species from extinction. This bill is part of an extinction agenda, which means that we are back in this subcommittee once again experiencing deja vu.
California Representative Jared Huffman is ranking member of the House Natural Resources Committee at a recent subcommittee hearing on updating the Endangered Species Act and delisting the gray wolf. Colorado Representative Lauren Bobar.
Our bill delists the gray wolf from the federal endangered species list and returns the issue of wolf management to the states and tribal wildlife agencies. Leftists want to eliminate hunting, lock up our lands, further restrict gun rights, use on our public lands, and pander to the interests of extreme environmentalists who don't understand any sense of our rural way of life. In 2020, voters in Denver and Boulder voted to reintroduce gray wolves west of the Continental Divide. This ballot box biology has led Colorado to rush through the importation of the Canadian gray wolves and has set them loose in our state despite numerous protests and questions about the legality and dysfunctional and chaotic approach to prioritizing predators over people. CPW began releasing gray wolves in the state without notifying landowners, livestock producers, and other reasonably concerned constituents of the location of the releases. Five of the released wolves came from packs with a known history of chronic livestock depredation. This misguided approach of importing foreign predators has received pushback from tribes, residents, energy operators, and most importantly, our farmers and ranchers. Delisting the gray wolf from the federal endangered species list will remove the current prohibitions and restrictions on land use activities, whether on public lands or private lands. DSA restrictions prohibit ranchers and pet owners from protecting their livestock and pets as ranchers who defend their sheep or cattle from wolves face potential prosecution.
She says, unfortunately, wolves don't respect boundaries.
Unfortunately, wolves don't see, they aren't aware of, they don't obey arbitrary lines. They don't know what state lines are, and they don't know the difference between state, federal, tribal, and private land. It's in their nature to travel great distances in pursuit of their prey, whether it's deer, elk, sheep, cattle, or even our pets. Last week, one of the Canadian wolves imported by CPW traveled from western Colorado up to northern Wyoming, Madam Chair, and killed five sheep. Now, these wolves were introduced west of the Continental Divide, but east of the Continental Divide last year, a gray wolf from the Great Lakes region was found over 1,000 miles away in Elbert County, Colorado, in my district. Not even wolves that were brought in by Colorado. Earlier this month, one of the Canadian wolves attacked and killed a working cattle dog in Jackson County, Colorado. Unfortunately, there are several stories just like this. And since 2021, 50 pets and livestock have been gruesomely attacked.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The Gulf of America has served as the backbone of U.S. energy production for decades.
Legislation introduced to codify the Gulf of America. Eric Molito, President, National Ocean Industries Association.
The U.S. has been producing oil in the federal Gulf of America waters since 1938, and production from the Gulf has been steadily increasing since the very beginning. In fact, the Gulf of America has been producing more than 1 million barrels of oil per day since 1997, and at its highest level of production on record, just over 2 million barrels in August of 2019, right before the onset of the pandemic. Today, the Gulf is producing about 1.8 million barrels of oil per day. With several high-tech projects coming online, we expect this number will increase considerably and further fortify America's energy security. In terms of energy affordability, production from the U.S. Gulf of America plays a substantial role in helping to meet domestic and global demand for energy, helping to put downward pressure on prices. I'd like to take a moment to recognize and thank the hardworking women and men of the Gulf of America oil and gas industry. For the past 80 years, the people of the offshore industry have been working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to produce the energy that we all rely upon for a high quality of life. We often take it for granted, but the energy we produce in the Gulf of America makes modern life possible, lifting standards of living for all Americans. From the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed, oil and natural gas are making everything we do possible. From air and car travel to heating and cooling to electricity generation to farming and education and healthcare, oil and gas make it happen. The Gulf of America oil and gas industry supports more than 400,000 high-paying jobs throughout the country. Most are along the Gulf Coast in places like Houma, Morgan City, Lafayette, and Covington, but there are companies and jobs in every state that get good work from the Gulf of America oil and gas industry. And the men and women of the offshore oil and gas industry work every day to protect each other, communities, and the environment. We continue to innovate and work collaboratively to efficiently produce energy, conserve resources, and protect the environment. Quite simply, we do more with less. Take this data point. If you take the 18 largest producing facilities in the Gulf of America, they collectively take up the space of about 9 city blocks. Yet they produce about 75% of all of the oil from the Gulf of America. This is more production than the entire state of North Dakota, which in and of itself is a prolific producing region. Gulf of America oil and gas industry also stands as a major contributor of revenue to the U.S. government and for important conservation programs. Over the past 25 years alone, our industry has paid more than $150 billion to the federal treasury with specific revenues allocated for our national parks, for the Land and Water Conservation Fund, for urban parks and recreation, and for coastal restoration. U.S. offshore oil and gas production provides Americans with the best product when it comes to low carbon intensity barrels. Oil produced from the Gulf of America has a carbon intensity per barrel that is 46% lower than the foreign average. Policies that restrict domestic offshore development require imports to make up the shortfall, and that supplemental production comes from higher emitting operations in other countries, often adversarial to our national security interests. It's critical that federal policy promotes U.S. energy development in our offshore region through consistent leasing, permitting, and reasonable regulation, and through open access to markets. This also includes taking important steps to streamline and provide greater certainty in the regulatory process through legislation like Chairman Westerman's ESA Amendments Act of 2025. This legislation seeks to advance the underlying purpose of the ESA of conserving and restoring endangered and threatened species while instituting logical change to actually make the law work.
Testifying recently before a House Natural Resources Subcommittee, it's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Despite the various pressures, despite the increases in financial stress at a modest pace, declines in repayment rates, tighter profit margins, higher interest rates, the uncertainty that we could spend the rest of the afternoon talking about, farm real estate values have held firm.
Nate Kaufman is with the Kansas City Federal Reserve, speaking recently at USDA's Ag Outlook Forum.
This is a very important thing to keep in mind. It's something to watch. If there was something that would potentially change with respect to land values, that would likely have outsized implications and importance for agriculture overall. The chart on the left-hand side is simply a picture of real estate, farm real estate values in the region that I mentioned earlier at the Kansas City Fed. This is in levels, meaning that this is essentially to say that if you started land values at an index of zero in 2010, this is to say that you're up to 125. That's a real substantial increase in land values over that time. So we haven't really seen much of a pullback there. And as Carrie mentioned in her slides, and this would be replicating the data from USDA, that's one of the primary reasons that we haven't really seen more of an uptick with respect to the debt-to-asset ratio. We know that lending has been increasing, especially the past year and a half. But part of the reason that these measures of solvency haven't gotten worse is because land has held up to the extent that it has, as you see in this picture on the left. As we look ahead, and I know we want to spend more time being thoughtful of what's to come over the next 12 months, just as much, if not more, as looking back at the last 12 months, most of the context that we would interact with and lenders that would be participating in providing us the data as it relates to land values and other measures of credit still have felt as though there could be further reductions in land values, or I should say some reductions in land values. This is the result of a survey that we ran the end of 2024. So to the point about recency of things that have happened since then, it obviously wouldn't be capturing everything. But the main point that I'd like to illustrate here is what you see with respect to the light blue bars here. These would be the share of lenders in the survey that indicated that they felt land values would decrease anywhere between 0 and 10%. So you can see that that share has been building. It was roughly 25% in 2022. Roughly 40% in the latest survey that expects some amount of deterioration with respect to land values. So again, adding to some of the sentiment that we were tracking through 2024 that will be important for seeing how things progress this year.
Mark Jackanowski is chairman of the World Ag Outlook Board.
Milk production forecast down this month, adjusted lower, 600 million pounds, mostly reflecting a reduction in output per cow. The other thing worth noting, slightly less trade. Our trade forecasts, both imports and exports, pulling back a bit this month. A few things driving that, relatively strong supplies coming out of Oceania, so global market competition. Higher domestic use, as you can see there, too. So we're using more of the product domestically, raised our domestic use forecasts, offsetting some of those lower exports. On a skim solids basis, the reduction in exports there, that is driven by lower non-fat dry milk exports. And you know, there might also be some trade policy uncertainty behind some of the recent trends as well. In terms of dairy product prices, prices are correcting a bit, but still high, still strong, just off their recent peaks. We could characterize it as adequate supplies, relatively lower export demand, all weighing a bit on prices, but these are still strong, even with the all milk price down $1 per hundredweight this month and down $1 year over year. Still very strong margins at the farm level, in part reflecting low feed costs.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's one part of relief assistance for farmers, the now dubbed USDA Emergency Commodity Assistance Program, now conducting sign-up for eligible growers through August 15th. Also part of the American Relief Act approved late last year, up to $20 billion in disaster relief payments for revenue loss or commodity damage associated with listed disasters. Farm Production and Conservation Deputy Undersecretary Brooke Appleton provides the update on this relief package.
We are in the process of getting that all together and rolling that out. There's about four different components to it. There are two different programs for livestock eligibility, one for wildfires and drought, and the other for flooding. And then there is a chunk of money that we will put towards doing block grants for states. And then the bulk of what is left will be that supplemental disaster program that we roll out.
With each component rolled out at different times based on program readiness. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.